You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another History of the Second World War interview. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Brett Holman, the author of The Next War in the Air, Britain's Fear of the Bomber, 1908 to 1941, and also the author of an upcoming book, Home Fires Burning, A Motion Spectacle in Britain's First War from the Air. Dr. Holman, how's it going today?
It's great. It's very nice to be joining you here from the other side of the world in Australia, thanks to the wonders of the internet.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
So the growth and impact of aviation during the First World War is well known. It's sort of, you know, part of the whole story. And part of that story was also the advent of aerial bombardment. Now, the bombing raids that were launched were not just aimed at military targets close to the fighting, but also included the bombing of military and civilian targets away from the front. Setting aside kind of the technological advancements or military impact of these raids, could you talk a little bit about the mental impact that these raids had on people who at any other previous time in history would have been far outside the danger zone or the danger area during a conflict?
Yeah, this is, I think, a very, very interesting aspect of this war from the air. To be clear, civilians are always affected by war. They've always been victims of war. But as you say, that's really before the 20th century, this was much more likely if you were close to the front lines. Sometimes there were things like shore bombardments of port cities and that sort of thing, where people, civilians who were supposedly safe, far from the war fighting, were suddenly thrust into the action. But generally, people in the home front could feel safe and secure that their armies were off fighting somewhere else and they would not be affected. And so it was a real mental shift for them to adjust to this idea of, I may be dozens or hundreds of miles away from the armies, but I'm now in danger and I have to think like I'm in danger. So this was a huge mental readjustment for many people. Again, that said, it was different for different countries. I think Britain, which is a country that I study particularly, it was especially a difficult transition because they were an island nation, still are an island nation. They traditionally had the English Channel between them and their prospective enemies. And of course, they had the Royal Navy to protect them, you know, those wooden walls and later iron walls to prevent any enemies from landing, which, you know, didn't always work, but it worked pretty much. You know, certainly throughout the 19th century, there was definitely complacency in Britain about the threat from overseas. But again, as always, this gets complicated because in Britain, there'd been this whole genre of invasion literature before the First World War, where they'd imagined German armies usually in landing and invading in a surprise attack, somehow having taken out the Royal Navy and landing under secret in dark or something like that and taking over London and that would be the end of the British Empire because, you know, they hadn't invested heavily enough in their army or some other aspect of defence. So there were concerns. So even though, so there's this sort of, this strange sort of double thing of complacency and anxiety, both worked sort of hand in hand before the First World War. So people had this sort of complex idea of We're safe, but maybe we're not so safe as we think. And then the aeroplane comes along, and the airship, of course. This immediately subverts the Royal Navy because it can just fly right over the English Channel and all those battleships and attack the home front directly. In theory, of course, the technology is not quite there to begin with to do this accurately or in strength, but it's just the mere possibility increases the anxieties. And so there's all this agitation before the First World War in Britain. You know, what should we do? How do we defend against this? We need our own air force. We need some weapons to defend against them. And so people start talking about this, but it's all couched in this terms of national strength. Britain is the world's, we need to remember, it was the world's leading superpower by some measures. It needed to be up there in the first rank of nations fighting in the air. It needed to be not just for defensive purposes, but also for offensive purposes. So it needed to be able to take the fight to the enemy. So there's, again, this double defensiveness, offensiveness. It's all there in the thinking. How far this affected people on the street, how far people, you know, the ordinary person cared about all this is hard to tell. There were things like, which fascinate me, the Phantom Airship panics before the First World War, where people imagined that they saw German Zeppelins flying over in the night sky over England, which, of course, were not there. We may imagine they might have been more likely to be aliens in flying saucers than actual German airships. But people did think this, and it was all over the press. And so there was a lot of discussion about those sneaky Germans coming over and preparing for the next war. By scouting out English skies under cover of night in peacetime. So, again, there's this anxiety that's bubbling up. And then you get to the war itself. At first, people, again, are not really very concerned about it, but it's when the sort of front lines start to harden in France on the Western Front. You get the war of movement ends. Paris is saved, but the Germans are firmly lodged in Eastern France and Belgium. The idea sort of arises, well, the Germans are not going to sort of rest on their laurels. They're going to strike somewhere, and they want to strike at Britain because Britain has become their primary enemy. And so they're going to use their Zeppelins to fly over this channel and bomb London. And so it was widely assumed that this would happen. The question was, what effect would it have? People were sort of told by the government that they had to prepare for this. They were told that the London streetlights were dimmed and external lighting was sort of lowered to make it less easy for Zeppelins to find it. By later standards of the blackout in World War II, this was a much less dramatic change, but it still would have been noticeable. Other than that, there was nothing like the civil defence measures of the 1930s and the 1940s. People were sort of told to look out for themselves and just follow the general directions of the police and that sort of thing. There were anxieties. Again, there are anxieties, but not really, and some fear. I would not say there was sort of panic or anything like that. People not that alarmed. But what sort of changed things was the sort of string of German atrocities in the 1914 and 1915, the slaughter of Belgian civilians, the use of gas, the sinking of the Lusitania. This all became part of this sort of narrative of the German war against civilization, German barbarism, and the Zeppelin attacks on civilians fitted right into that. So people became more angry than scared. There was more hate, I think, in the early days. And certainly the press sort of amped that up and sort of talking about the correct response against these early attacks, which after all were not very heavy. They only killed, all deaths, of course, were regrettable, but they only killed a handful of civilians. The press played these up as pathetic victims of the Kaiser's hatred against England, but the actual damage was minimal. And so a lot of it was about the press connecting it as part of this narrative of poison gas and barbarism and using those attacks to drive hatred against the Germans.
I'm stuck with the mental image of a Britain in the pre-war years, like looking up and thinking they see a Zeppelin, having probably no real clue exactly what a Zeppelin would look like at night flying above them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, many of these people had never seen anything flying, you know, aircraft or even, you know, there were a few small airships in Britain, but most people who sort of saw these things had not seen anything like those aircraft before. And so it was a lot of it was just what they imagined or what they saw in the press. It's what they were told that airships would look like. And, you know, usually it was night and what they saw was a bright light, you know, sort of shining down, which they took to be a searchlight on the bottom of the airship, which, you know, was not actually a thing which airships carried very often or used very often because they were very heavy things and they didn't want to give their position away. But, you know, this was sort of the idea that it got out. And so this is what everyone started seeing. Oh, there's a bright light over on the horizon. That must be an airship. And so the press, you know, as you can imagine, had a field day with this. There were newspapers who said, yes, it's the Germans definitely coming over. Who else could it be? And there were other ones saying, it's actually the government or British inventors who are developing our own airships and testing them secretly at night. And then there were others who said this is all, you know, hysteria and the press itself is to blame for sort of whipping up a frenzy about it, which is, you know, sort of more or less what I believe to be the case. Mm-hmm. So it sort of fits in with a lot of those invasion scares and the spy panics as well, the idea that there are German spies embedded throughout London ready to sort of strike at the day when the German army does invade. And so it was all part of this pattern of German hostility towards Britain and underhanded methods, these sort of sneaky methods to overcome British strength because they're so jealous of Britain. So it all fits into that picture, mental picture that a lot of people sort of subscribe to. Before the First World War.
And so when we're talking about the war itself and we're talking about the air raids that occurred, so what were some of the targets, say in Britain, and what are we looking at in terms of, you know, raid size, damage caused, those kind of quantitative metrics, I guess?
Yeah, well, there are, in theory, you know, the Germans always, you know, claimed that they were attacking fortified positions. So according to the Hague conventions before the war, the only sort of permissible attack against cities were if they were from the air. It was a bit ambiguous, but it was if they were fortified positions, meaning, you know, they were fortress cities, they had guns that were capable of defending themselves. And so the Zeppelin commanders would always say, oh, they'd been fired upon by anti-aircraft guns, even when British records show that there were no guns in the area. It was a standard thing to say, we attacked a legitimate target. They did attack. The most heavily bombed target was London, obviously, but also Hull, which is up on the northeast coast of the North Sea, partly because it was, you know, a fairly important, though minor, port, a fishing port, really, some shipbuilding, I think. But it was also, its location meant it was easy to find. It was on the coast. It was a relatively short distance. So the Zeppelins could fly in and fly out without exposing themselves to too much risk. It was bombed quite heavily as well. And then later in the war, when the aeroplanes started bombing, the Gothers, they bombed the southeast corner, Kent, Ramsgate and Dover and places like that fairly heavily, as well as London. So those were the areas which were bombed the heaviest. The Zeppelins did penetrate as far north as Edinburgh, and they did attempt to raid the Midlands, Manchester and Birmingham, which, you know, were heavy centres of industry. They didn't have much luck getting to those targets because it was just the navigational problem was just too hard and the weather often interfered. Those were also some of the biggest raids, Zeppelin raids. Normally, the raids were carried out by, you know, one, two, three Zeppelins. They could be up to five or six. Were about the biggest, maybe a bit more. They often had difficulties coordinating those attacks because the Zeppelins would not fly in a sort of fleet formation. They might start out together, but they usually took their own routes to the targets. The communications in the air between the airships was not very useful. It ended up being a bit random. You know, three airships might head out for London. One would end up hitting London. One would, you know, reach Norfolk. Another one would turn back. So it was they had a great difficulty in concentrating their forces on any given target. As to what they wanted to achieve, the basic idea was that they wanted to basically frighten the British people out of the war. They wanted to cause terror. They wanted to cause fear. They wanted the British people themselves to say, well, this isn't worth fighting. They wanted to strike back for the blockade, the British blockade of Germany, the naval blockade, which was at times caused serious privations in Germany in terms of food. But sometimes the Germans said that this particular raid was a reprisal for an Allied air raid on a German city. So they sort of sometimes tried to justify it that way. But really the idea was they wanted to cause emotional effects in Britain. And the German press would sort of fondly describe the terrifying effects that it had in London and elsewhere, these raids, you know, with people, the city in flames and masses of people panicking. And this was based on neutral journalists and opinion, but it was vastly exaggerated. There was nothing like what they were describing. There was isolated incidents of panic and terror and that sort of thing, isolated incidents of high casualties, but generally the Zeppelins in particular did very little damage. It was really a bit disappointing for the Germans that they spent all this effort sending the Zeppelins over to so little effect, apparently, although to be fair, it was hard for them to tell because of the British government did clamp down on the reporting of the raids in the British press. So after the very first raid on London, they said they prohibited British newspapers from publishing details of the raids in terms of casualties and damage and even the locations. So it was hard for the Germans to actually get accurate information as to what their airships were doing.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, it's kind of hard for the Germans to determine the effects of what they're doing. But then after the war was over, kind of how did sort of air power theorists and planners view the events of the First World War? You know, strategic bombing as a concept is a major part of planning during the interwar years. And so how did strategic bombing enthusiasts and critics view the events of the First World War? How did they kind of analyze those in their own views?
Yeah, this is a really important topic because it does have consequences for not only the interwar period, but the Second World War as well. So, yeah, the analysts did pay attention to what had happened in the First World War, because obviously that was the only major example, the only major evidence they had to draw upon. But equally, they argued that it was limited. So, you know, the forces were limited, the number of aircraft were limited, the technology was limited. And this is the thing about aviation, particularly in this period, is it was the technological growth was, you know, staggering. Things were always getting better, faster, more powerful, longer ranges. Everything was happening, was pointing in the direction of more destructive capabilities in the future. And so this is what they did, was they took those examples of the First World War, and they sort of quite naively extrapolated to the present day, the 1920s and 30s, and into the future, and say, yeah, okay, that was however bad that was, and they'd also take the isolated examples, the worst cases, and sort of use that to extrapolate from. So, you know, there were cases during the air raids in Britain where one bomb leveled an entire street in London, Warrington Crescent. And so you find people writing about this in the interwar period, and they'd have maps of the street and showing, you know, how many their streets, the houses that were destroyed, the houses that were damaged. And they'd say, well, imagine this was just one bomb did this. Imagine a whole fleet of, you know, 1,000 aircraft dropping 10 of these bombs. Imagine what it will do to a city and day after day, not just at random sort of intervals. So, you know, they had this made for a fairly persuasive picture because it was based on, you know, some reality and sort of the evidence of what everyone can see through the press and through newsreels and going to air shows and things, is that, you know, aviation was going ahead in leaps and bounds. And so, of course, in the future, of course, it's going to be more powerful and more destructive. And so this idea came about by the 1930s of the knockout blow from the air, that this would be irresistible, this first strike, or not even just the first strike, but even just a few weeks of bombing, and there'll be no way that any nation would be able to withstand that, and unless they were able to do even worse to the enemy. Because this is one of the other lessons that was drawn from the First World War, which was that air defense was basically ineffective. This was a fallacious inference, I would say. The Zeppelins had in fact been defeated by Britain's air defenses. They'd worked out how to shoot them down fairly regularly by the end of 1916. But it was the Gothas, which the aeroplane bombers, which threw the British air defences for a loop, so to speak, in 1917 and 1918. They launched some spectacular daylight raids over London, which everyone could see were not intercepted by the British air defenders. And you know, they only lost very small numbers of aircraft to the defences, which did include anti-aircraft guns. And so these raids were exceptionally damaging, more damaging than the Zeppelin raids. And so the idea came about that you know, the aeroplane was the raider of the future, which was correct. You know, the airship had its day by 1917, but that there was no way for fighter aircraft to effectively defend against aeroplane bombers. They were just too fast. The sky was too big. There'd be too many of them, and that, yeah, they'd shoot down some, but this would have very little effect against a determined enemy, and they'd always be able to press home the attack and drop their bombs and lay, which might include poison gas, of course. And so this would lay waste to an entire city, and it was rather pointless. But in fact, the British underestimated the effectiveness of their air defences. Some elements of the Royal Air Force did understand that it was effective, and that's why they actually did maintain that air defence structure through to 1940, which is a good thing. But you know, the politicians and the air ministry generally, and the sort of all the pundits in the press, sort of said, no, you know, the Gothas in 1917 proves that we can't fight against this. So, you know, we need to have bombers of our own to take the war to Germany or whoever and beat them at that game rather than sitting there and take it. So, yeah, it was complicated. The legacy of the First World War was misinterpreted, I argue, and it kind of makes sense when you see it from the point of view of the 1930s, but they sort of work themselves into a they kind of scared themselves for no reason, the people who were sort of afraid of the bomber in the 1930s. It was a vastly exaggerated threat. As terrible as it was, of course, the strategic bombing campaigns of the 1940s, they never came close to knocking Britain out of the war in the way that was envisaged in the 1930s.
On the other side of the post-war equation, we have kind of the civilian view of strategic bombing, you know. Did memories of the bombing campaigns of the First World War play a role in the concerns about the dangers posed, you know, by attacks in the next war, whenever that might occur?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question that I've looked at. I need to look at it more. But yeah, I mean, when you think about people who are living in London in 1935, 1940, millions of those would have been alive in 1917 and would have experienced the air raids then. And so it's a really interesting question as to how their own memories and their own experiences affected how they prepared, you know, physically and mentally for this next war. And we do have some evidence in the form of in 1935, there was one of the Rothermere newspapers started up a campaign called the National League of Airmen, which was designed to pressure the government into expanding the Air Force. And part of this was through exaggerating this or playing on this fear of the bomber and saying we need a big Air Force so that we won't be vulnerable to this. But one of the aspects that they, one of the strategies they tried to do was to get readers to write in with their memories and experiences of the First World War and to reflect upon what this meant for the defence of Britain, air defence of Britain today. I've sort of gone through these letters and collected, try to get a little database of them. And there's about 100 of them, I think, across a few weeks. And so these people who are writing in were very affected by their memories and what had happened to them. There were some terrible stories of, you know, my daughter, you know, she was in a house that was hit by a bomb. She has never been able to work or leave the house since then. My, you know, grandmother died of shock after the raid in 1918. I fear for the next generation who have to go through this again. I still have nightmares about it. I don't want to put my children through this again. So, you know, there are people who are really affected by it. Some of these stories I have to chase up because it's interesting because it gives a sort of longitudinal study of the effects of the air raids. If you look at the immediate casualty lists of, you know, people who were killed and wounded at the time, you know, that's one measure of their damage, but the emotional effects can last for many, many decades and were not really reported at the time. And so it gives an interesting insight into those emotional after effects. On the other hand, of course, it's not exactly a scientific sample. It's selected. These people are self-selecting. They're exaggerating perhaps to sort of get their letters noticed by the press, and there was also a prize for the best letter in each issue. Then they were being selected by the editors, of course, who were selecting the most interesting or sort of out there letters. And of course, it's for a political campaign to pressure the government. So it's all propaganda. So I do want to try and look at these closely and sort of see if I can verify some of the details of them. And they often did include full names and addresses. So I can do that, but it's taken sort of as it stands. It was in itself, it's an interesting argument to say that was presented at this time in 1935 to say these air raids, people do remember them. They still remember them. It affects how we're thinking, how we need to think about the next war because it's going to be so much worse. But it was bad enough as it was. So people did have memories, and that's something that I'm really interested in following up on.
Even somebody with the best of intentions writing 17 years later, you know, memories become different over that time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, there's a whole field of sort of oral history which takes a lot of care into looking at how people reconstruct their memories after the event, to sort of in light of their changing beliefs, their changing understanding of what had happened, their later experiences. You know, the meaning that something had at one point in your life is different to the meaning it has later in your life. And so, you know, yeah, as you say, these people are not necessarily trying to pull one over anyone, but how they react to what had happened to them in 1917, sorry, how they react to it in 1935 is going to be different to how they react to it in 1917. And that in itself is a really fascinating topic. And so it's something I'll be getting up to in the last chapter of my book, I expect, which seems a long way off from now.
Speaking of books, you know, I know you're continuing to do research on some of these topics. So what is the book that you're working on, and what are you kind of, you know, actively researching right now?
Yeah, so thank you for asking. So my current book project that I'm working on is on the First World War air raids. The kind of way I'm looking at it is there have been a lot of books that have been written about it, these air raids, the Zeppelins and the Gothas, and a lot of excellent books. What I'm interested in is not so much the details of what happened, but the way people sort of experienced them and the way they did feel about them. So sort of emotions and spectacle, because I argue these had a, it's part, as I explained just before, that the raids themselves generally had little physical effect, but it's the emotional experiential effects that I think were key to understanding their impact, because they were, the effects of these raids were much bigger than just the bomb damage itself. And so I'm still in the sort of early days of the project, although sometimes it doesn't seem like it, but currently I'm looking at the first raids on London in 1915, and the way that people responded to these by turning against what they saw as the enemy within. So after the first raid, there were riots in the east end of London against people of German extraction, because there was a German community in London, which had been there for many years, long, well established. But of course, when the war came along, these people were in a precarious position. Their loyalties were doubted, even though some of them had, you know, didn't even speak German. With third generation or something like that. So any German shops were sort of often targeted, butchers and bakers and all that sort of thing. So they were targeted by rowdy crowds who sort of wanted some sort of payback for what had happened. These raids, so that sounds pretty terrible, was terrible, but it was actually a fairly minor sequel to what had happened a few weeks earlier when the Lusitania had been sunk by a U-boat off Ireland. And the riots there were much more extensive. Again, this connects with the idea of anger and hatred towards the Germans for what they felt to be, what was felt to be a sort of frightful, was the word that was used, way of waging war, not honourable at all, not decent, which, you know, was contrasted with the supposed British way of fighting. And so there was a pattern of these riots early on the raids, when other towns were attacked, like Southend and Hull, there were riots as well. And it was an emotional response, you know, partly some way of releasing these emotions that were, you know, this feeling we talked about earlier before, you know, we're now under attack. There's nothing we can do to strike back against the Zeppelins, but here is something we can strike back against, even if it's not actually an enemy. But there was also, as I said earlier, there was this discourse of German spies, you know, riddling British society, German spies and saboteurs. And there were stories about that signals were being flashed to the Zeppelins, so, you know, that they were being guided into their targets by people on the ground. In the first raids on Norfolk in January 1915, there were stories of a motor car zooming through the back roads of the countryside with its headlights on, flashing a signal to the Zeppelin that came in and dropped its bombs there in the first raid. And so, there were all these fears and paranoias about the German enemy within, which was stoked up by the press, some elements of the press beforehand, which said, you know, we need to be concerned about these people. They're a danger to us. When the raid comes, they're going to rise up and attack, our public buildings, blow up bridges, attack communications, all that sort of thing. And so I'm trying to, so this is the topic that I'm working on at the moment, these riots and the sort of fears that sort of fed into them and resulted from them. So, yeah, I'm kind of having fun unpacking all of that and going through with the newspapers at the time and trying to work out what evidence I have. There's diaries and memoirs and things which also help, and government reports on some of this violence. So, yeah, so it's a lot of fun.
It sounds very interesting. I can't wait to check it out at some far future date.
Yes, far future. A couple of years, I think, off. But, as I said, 1915. So I've still got, a few more years of the war to get through.
That's how it goes. Thank you so much for joining us here tonight and for talking about these really interesting topics.
Oh, thanks for having me, Wesley. It's been great.